On the 1st of May 1946, Aboriginal stock workers started to leave stations across the Pilbara region in Western Australia. This was the beginning of one of the great, one of the first great Aboriginal strikes that rocked post-war Australian society and called into question more than 150 years of oppression and exploitation. Support for the strike flowed in from workers' organisations across the country. Don McLeod, the white communist who had helped organise the Pilbara strike, had told the Aboriginal workers that they would have power behind us, and he was quickly proven right. 19 unions in Western Australia, 7 national unions, 4 trades and labour councils, and innumerable local trade union branches supported the strike and sent money. And in 1949, the communist-led Seamen's Union would bring the struggle to a climax of a boycott of wool shipping that broke the last resistance of the station owners. The Pilbara strike then was both a heroic struggle against racism and an important event in the history of the workers' movement in Australia. While Aboriginal oppression would, of course, endure, the strike was a significant blow to the racist structures of Western Australian capitalism. And it was also an important turning point in the relationship between the workers' movement and Aboriginal rights. While there had definitely been previous examples of solidarity with Aboriginal people by trade unions and the socialist left throughout the first part of the 20th century and even into the 19th century, the Pilbara strike was on a larger scale than some of these previous examples. It involved over 800 Aboriginal workers withdrawing their labour for 3 years in direct defiance of the station owners, the police and the state government. Trade unions organised support for the strikers across the country and laid the base for future expressions of solidarity with the Aboriginal strikes in Darwin after World War II as well, in the Gringee strike that started in 1966, and the land rights battles of the 1970s. The strike itself and the support it garnered and the enemies it confronted all revealed very clearly how issues of race, class and capitalism are deeply intertwined in Australian society and Australian history. And I'll start with some background to the strike. So this is just a map for people who don't know really where the Pilbara region is and some of the main kind of places around it. So Aboriginal labour had played an important role in the Pilbara since the 19th century. As early as 1879, for instance, all the 18,000 sheep on the large coastal station of Munda were shepherded by Aboriginal workers. And in 1883, a newspaper article reported on the De Grey station, which is on the map there, which had over 40,000 sheep and 6,000 cattle, all the work was done by Aboriginal workers. And Aboriginal women also played an important role, both as domestic servants, and one of the complaints during the strike was often by the wives of the station managers about how, you know, they can't get all the domestic work done because all the Aboriginal women had supported the strike, but also many Aboriginal women did station work as well, actually. These Aboriginal men and women lived and worked under appalling conditions, backed up by a ruthless system of racist exploitation and violence. When the settlers had first arrived in the Pilbara region, there had been large-scale massacres of the Aboriginal community. During the 1800s, over 50 Aboriginal people fishing in a stream had been shot down by the Europeans. Another incident involved a much larger group being driven into a tidal swamp and then shot to death. When a white settler was speared in retaliation, station owners rounded up the local Aboriginal people, forced them to build a funeral pyre, and then burnt 80 of them alive on top of the funeral pyre. An 1886 newspaper reported afterwards that the Aboriginal people had been taught a lesson that they have never forgot and were now the most useful in the district. While such brutal and open violence was less common by the 1940s, Aboriginal labour was still strictly controlled by the station owners, and there was always the threat of violence in the background. The station owners used their control over rations and access to traditional lands to enforce exploitative labour conditions. Aboriginal people were required to live in designated native camps close to the station homesteads, but out of the way of the most useful land for cattle and sheep. And if Aboriginal people left the camp without the station owner's permission, then the police would be sent to track them down and force them to return. On the other hand, if Aboriginal people came to live in a camp who the station owner decided were not useful for labour, or were considered to be a bad influence upon the Aboriginal workers, then the police would be called in and they would be driven away or arrested. The role that Aboriginal labour played in Western Australia was often deliberately obscured by the bosses themselves to justify the fact that they very rarely paid these workers in wages and the other, you know, horrible exploitation that they oversaw. The bosses would often argue that they only allowed Aboriginal people to work out of a sense of charity. They argued that, you know, even though they didn't have to pay them, they had to give them rations and they had to give their children rations and their, you know, parents and grandparents and so forth. And so actually this is a huge burden upon the station. So that was the argument they raised all the time, particularly as they said that the Aboriginal workers were, you know, really lazy and wouldn't work properly. All of this, of course, was just a load of lies and propaganda. In reality, through a combination of outright violence and, you know, the control that the bosses had, the pastoralists disciplined Aboriginal workers into a highly profitable workforce that could be paid well beyond other workers, you know, what they would be willing to accept. And there's, you know, lots of different kind of examples of this. Probably the clearest evidence for how important Aboriginal labour was in the Pilbara is the response of station owners whenever there was proposals for the government to regulate the employment of Aboriginal people. And when that happened, they raised, you know, holy hell against it. At the Mosley Commission in 1934, for instance, Bob Coverley, who was the Labor MP for the Pilbara region and later the Labor Minister for Native Affairs in Western Australia, voices opposition to any government regulations on the exploitation of Aboriginal workers, criticising what he called the stupid system of protecting the Aborigines to the detriment of the white settlers as a whole. And Charles Baxter, who was a country Labor MP, told the Western Australian Parliament in 1943 that if the government was given too much control of Aboriginal labour, it would render the position of the pastoral industry impossible, in so much as those engaged in that industry will not have the labour available from the native race. So this gives an idea about, you know, how central it really was. It's worth saying here briefly about the impact of the Second World War on the Aboriginal workers in the Pilbara. Many left-wing historians of Aboriginal workers and the kind of history have often discussed how the Second World War had a contradictory impact upon Aboriginal workers in the rest of Australia. While racist discrimination didn't disappear, labour shortages in key industries did mean that many Aboriginal workers were able to gain employment in jobs that had previously been denied to them. In Darwin, for instance, hundreds of Aboriginal people worked to support the military bases that were established there, and some were paid significantly higher wages than they were before, even if, you know, many of them weren't paid the same as white workers. And they also came into contact with more unionised white workers in the cities. And historians have argued that this laid the basis for more sympathetic attitudes towards Aboriginal workers by some white workers in the post-war period, as well as giving a greater confidence to Aboriginal workers to stand up for their rights. While this was true about Darwin and probably true about some other places in Australia, the impact of the war in the Pilbara was very different. The pastoral industry was designated as an essential wartime industry by the government. It was made illegal for any of the Aboriginal workers to leave the Pilbara stations to be employed anywhere else. Instead, they were even more viciously exploited by the station owners in order to help the war effort. A military base was built in Port Hedland, but Aboriginal workers vital to the production of wool were not employed in either its construction nor its maintenance. And none of the Aboriginal strikers in 1946 were ever employed by the military whatsoever. So the interaction between Aboriginal white workers in Darwin was not replicated in the Pilbara region. Just before the war and in its early stages, some Aboriginal people in the region had been able to improve their conditions somewhat. So in Port Hedland, some Aboriginal people had formed an association to campaign for greater civil liberties, particularly amongst the so-called half-caste Aboriginal people in the town. And they had had some success in breaking down some of the segregation there. However, during the war, all of these gains were reversed. And in fact, even harsher racist segregation was introduced into the town and the surrounding areas. And this was reinforced by the fear in military intelligence circles that in the outcome of a Japanese invasion of Northern Australia, the Aboriginal people would be sympathetic to the Japanese. And so there was a huge spying operation undertaken of the Aboriginal community to try and work out whether they were, you know, had some ties to the Japanese military or secretly disloyal to Australia. The main impact of the war then was not that changes in employment gave greater confidence for Aboriginal people to stand up for their rights, but rather that the intensified economic exploitation and racism of the Pilbara started to come into conflict with a growing left-wing anti-racist consciousness, which was increasing amongst sections of Australian society. And this opened up the potential for greater support for actions by Aboriginal workers in the Pilbara. And one person who was particularly impacted by this conflict was Don McLeod. And there's a picture of Don McLeod with a nice little grin there. Wonder what he's up to. McLeod was born in 1908 in a town on the mid-coast of Western Australia, and he spent the 1930s working as a rural labourer and asbestos miner. Before 1936, by his own admission, he had pretty standard, you know, mainstream racist ideas about Aboriginal people. When a fellow miner from Britain asked him why more Aboriginal people weren't allowed to work outside the stations, McLeod remembered replying, "Well, Aboriginal people like living in the open and squatters feed them, and there'll be a charge on the state if they didn't feed them. Just a normal thing that people had to say about blackfellas because I knew no better." How the comment by the other miner that he thought Aboriginal workers were intelligent fellows stayed with McLeod when he left mining and went to work in North and West Australia in 1942. There he worked at Roy Hill Station, well sinking alongside an Aboriginal man named Kitchener, who was unpaid for his work. While Kitchener was involved in the initial stages of the 1946 strike, he also became McLeod's friend and they had long discussions about the treatment of Aboriginal people in the region. At Roy Hill, McLeod also became friends with another Aboriginal man of mixed descent called Edgar Lockyer. McLeod and Lockyer were both fired after a dispute with the manager of Roy Hill, and the manager kept Lockyer's tools and his truck, allegedly to cover his debt because he had been kicked off before he'd finished his work. The abuse and power of the white station owner towards him further shocked McLeod and reinforced his interest in the question of Aboriginal exploitation. After being fired, McLeod moved to the town of Marble Bar, and there he joined the local branch of the Anti-Fascist League, or the AFL. The AFL had been set up by the Perth communist, Bill Beebe, in 1940, following the banning of the Communist Party. By the time that McLeod joined the AFL, it had over 2,700 members and 72 branches throughout Western Australia. They had a regular radio program in which they talked about racism towards Aboriginal people, you know, as well as many other issues. McLeod became the secretary of the Marble Bar branch of the AFL, and at its first meeting passed a resolution that the branch would use every means necessary to endeavour to assist the coloured people in their attempt to gain equality, both social and economic and political. And McLeod and the local branch there linked up with the association Port Hedland in order to support their civil rights campaigns. When all this came to an end with the tightening of oppression during the later period of the war, McLeod changed his focus to the Aboriginal workers in the Pilbara. And I'll talk about some of these figures in a bit, but it's some of the Aboriginal workers who McLeod is about to come into contact with. Now, the exact origins of the 1946 strike itself are a little bit murky. Before McLeod came onto the scene, there definitely were some Aboriginal workers who had floated the idea of strike action. However, these seem to have been particularly militant individuals who found it difficult to convince a broad layer of Aboriginal workers to take the risk in defying all the racist structures of Pilbara society. Many Aboriginal workers were understandably afraid that if they did so, that this would lead to the white population massacring the Aboriginal community, as had happened throughout the 1800s. As one Aboriginal striker named Peter Coppin recalled many years later, "The feeling among Aborigine people was building up everywhere, but there was nothing we could do, you know. People got the feeling that we're not getting a fair go, and at the same time, we didn't know how to start. The reality is we just really didn't know what to do about it." Here, McLeod made an important intervention. While the exact dates are unclear, by 1944 at least, McLeod had been involved in discussions with some of the Aboriginal workers already interested in strike action. And these Aboriginal workers included Clancy McKinnon and Dooley Binbin, who are in the slide there, and Daisy Bindi, who comes into it a bit later on. And they would become very important leaders of the strike in 1946. McLeod gave these future strike leaders the political arguments that would give them the confidence to convince broader layers of Aboriginal workers to join them in strike action. First of all, McLeod argued that there'd been a shift in attitudes of at least some people in Australia towards Aboriginal people. While the station owners were still undoubtedly cruel racists and governments backed them up, there were many ordinary people who'd be outraged if striking Aboriginal workers were just murdered by the government. So Jack Mathee, who was one of the Aboriginal strikers, recalls Clancy McKinnon telling him, "You see, I found out some things from McLeod, Jack. White people can't kill us these days, that's too much. All they can do is try and frighten us, tell lies about us, and try and put us in jail. Reinforcing this argument was McLeod's belief that if the Aboriginal workers went on strike, they would not, you know, just be isolated and defeated. And there were two reasons for this. Firstly, Aboriginal labour was the bedrock of the Pilbara pastoral industry. And secondly, there'd been a growing sympathy towards Aboriginal people amongst working class activists and organisations, not just in Perth, but around the country. McLeod had already been in contact with Ernie Fortin, the communist leader of the Iron Workers Union in Sydney, with the liberal anthropologist A.P. Elkin, with the communist writer Catherine Susanna Pritchard, as well as the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Australia itself, and he had asked for advice about tactics for the strike. The positive response he had received gave Don McLeod the confidence to argue that the Pilbara workers went on strike, they would not just be isolated, but they would have power behind them. These arguments helped give confidence to the Aboriginal strike leaders like McKinnon and Bimbin, and throughout 1945, serious preparations for a strike on the stations began. Semi-secret meetings of Aboriginal workers took place in stations across the Pilbara. At one such meeting in July 1945, a strike committee was elected, which included McKinnon, Kitchener, Jack Choppin, as well as representatives from many other stations. And the members of the strike committee then went back to their stations to spread the word about the strike and start collecting funds. And a series of further meetings in the second half of 1945 were held to argue against those Aboriginal workers who were still unsure about taking strike action, as well as to set a date, the 1st of May 1946, being, you know, May Day, of course, the traditional day of celebration for the labour and socialist movement. As McKinnon later put it, McLeod had given us a hint about the strike and we took it up. Now, there is some mythology about the beginnings of the strike on the 1st of May, and that's not, you know, particularly a big deal, not that surprising. There's a certain level of myth about all the great kind of struggles throughout history. The standard account is that on the 1st of May, 800 Aboriginal workers walked off on stations across the Pilbara. And while it is probably true, pretty definitely true, that the high point of the strike over a year later, around 800 workers were involved, things were messier to begin with for a number of reasons. First of all, on a number of stations, the white managers were so taken by surprise by the strike that they offered immediate reforms, which stopped the strike action from spreading, you know, beyond a day or two. So this happened at the Large de Grey station and at the Pipingara station, where station owners agreed to give workers wages instead of rations. However, as will later become clear, the station owners' intent was to only give wages for the duration of the shearing season. And when this stopped some months later, this led to more workers joining the strike. And at other stations, there were Aboriginal workers who backed down in the face of threats from the station owners. So on the 30th of April, the Aboriginal workers at the Munda station told the owner that they intended to strike from the 1st of May. He told them that they would be driven off if they did, and the police called and gave them half an hour to rethink. And most of the Aboriginal workers at Munda then decided to call off the strike. In other stations, the threat was even more blunt. One station owner simply took out a bag with metal chains and shackles in it, dumped it in front of the workers, and asked them who would be the first to put them on, with the result that most backed down from the strike to begin with. However, some stations did, of course, strike and stay on strike, and they were joined by Aboriginal town workers and miners at Marble Bar, as well as in other areas around the Pilbara. These Aboriginal workers walked off the stations and gathered at what would become the two main strike camps throughout the years of the strike, at Mooliyella and at 12 Mile. As I said, strike camps would eventually be established there. Now, while a couple of hundred workers had probably engaged in some form of strike action around the 1st of May, and a few hundred others had intended to do so, but then had backed down, hence the 800 number that people talk about. By the end of the first week of May, there was only around 30 Aboriginal workers who had walked off for more than a couple of days to join the strike camps. And the initial weakness of the strike seemed to lull authorities into a sense of calm. Only one station, Indy, reported that they were unable to shear their sheep because of labour shortages. One of the police inspectors reported at the end of the first week of May to his superiors that there's reason to believe that the trouble is clearing up. But in reality, it was only just beginning. And that's a picture of some of the strikers as it develops. Well, despite the fact that the strike seemed to be failing, the police and station owners moved quickly to suppress its leadership. While some warned at the time that this would only increase support for the strike, The authorities proceeded to arrest first McKinnon and Doyley, and then McLeod as well. The police seemed to believe that this would put an end to the strike. One inspector, though, was more doubtful and reported after the arrests that work is continuing in all the Pilbara stations, but I feel there's still an undercurrent of unrest on most of them. McLeod has been discredited, but the natives are still not quite sure of the position in many circumstances, as they have been unable to grasp the significance of his arrest, and it will take some time for readjustment. In reality, the arrests were a big misstep for the bosses and the police, unleashing widespread support for McKinnon, Doyley, and McLeod, and encouraging rather than undermining the strike. In Perth, hundreds attend protest meetings against the arrests, and I'll talk a bit about those solidarity actions later. In the Pilbara itself, the arrests pushed previously unsure Aboriginal workers to support the strike. McLeod sent out messages to supporters in Perth and on the stations through an Aboriginal police tracker, Tommy, who secretly supported the strike. While McLeod would eventually be fined a large sum, McKinnon and Doyley were released early due to, despite being convicted, due to the public pressure that was brought to bear. In June and July, the shearing season started to come to an end. And as it did, the two sections of Aboriginal workers who had sympathised with the strike but not left during May started to leave the stations in large numbers. For those that had won wages or wage increases, they now found that the station owners were only going to pay them for the shearing season and that they would now be returning to rations. Those workers who had backed down over fear of repression saw in the early release of McKinnon and Dooley the limits to police powers. At the end of July, there were big meetings of Aboriginal people during the annual races, and afterwards, several hundred strikers refused to return to work and now gathered at the enlarged strike camps. In August, McLeod was arrested again, just as the strike was spreading. This time, Aboriginal workers marched into Port Hedland in a procession, and the march shocked the white establishment of the town. One striker later recalled that the white women in the town were getting alarmed and they kept ringing up the police to find out what was happening. The natives, after all, are not supposed to be in the town. They should be kept out on the reserve, they kept saying. By the time the procession got to the jail, McLeod had actually already been released on bail, but the Aboriginal workers were naturally suspicious and they marched throughout the town calling out for him while the shops and businesses closed their doors as they moved throughout the town. And this action was a sign of the growing confidence of the strikers to defy the racist norms of Pilbara society. Meanwhile, a strong movement of solidarity was building in Perth and throughout the rest of the country. McLeod had argued to the Pilbara strikers that they would receive support from others, and in particular trade unions and working class organisations, and he was proven correct. The imprisonment of McKinnon and Dooley and the arrest of McLeod sparked a vigorous and broad-based response in Perth. Prominent individuals, church groups, unions and women's organisations came together to protest the repression and support the strikers' demands. Hundreds attend protest meetings in Perth and the support spread throughout the country. As I said before, 19 unions in Western Australia, 7 national unions, 4 trades and labour councils, and just dozens and dozens of local trade union branches supported the strike. And just to give some idea, probably can't see all of that, but this is a leaflet about one of the meetings that happens on May 28th, so just a few weeks after the strike has begun. And this is an article from the Communist Party newspaper, which is about the arrests that had taken place. Now, the communists played a key role in this solidarity action in Perth, establishing the Committee for the Defence of Native Rights, or the CDNR, and they sent an Anglican minister, Peter Hodge, to investigate the strike. And when he was there, he was arrested by the local police, leading to another round of protests and meetings around the country. Now, all of this was not some spontaneous expression of solidarity. This came out of nowhere. A key role was played by the Communist Party of Australia, and the groundwork for supporting the Pilbara strikers had already been laid by almost 2 decades of work by Communist Party militants in trade unions and working class communities across the country. Throughout the 20th century, the communists had made an important contribution to the struggle for Aboriginal rights. For decades, communists had stood their ground against the grain of racism in Australian society, criticising the mainstream of the labour movement for its failure to take up Aboriginal rights seriously and condemning the Australian Labour Party for its role in enforcing oppression and racism at both a state and federal level. And that was important because for the first half of the strike in WA, the Labour Party was in state government. And these weren't just words. The communists sought to build solidarity with Aboriginal struggles and promote anti-racist ideas amongst its predominantly working class membership and audience. And at first, this contribution was had been mainly kind of propaganda in terms of articles exposing particular abuses. But as the Communist Party had grown in influence throughout the 1930s, they took these arguments into the arenas of left-wing struggle. First, the unemployed movement, then the trade unions, and then broader political campaigns. And the process, the Communist Party had trained hundreds, if not thousands, of working class activists to be sensitive to the oppression of Aboriginal people and to be ready to show solidarity when Aboriginal people fought back against the racism of Australian society. And this laid the basis for the relatively rapid response of solidarity shown to the Pilbara strike. McLeod himself had joined the Communist Party sometime in the 1940s. Years later, when he had parted with the communists, McLeod would claim that he had only joined for like pragmatic reasons. So he only joined because, you know, the CPA were one of the few parties that cared about Aboriginal people and they had these connections to the trade unions. However, there is substantial evidence that at least during the 40s, McLeod was ideologically committed to the Communist Party. Catherine Susanna Pritchard, Dorothy Hewitt, and Joan Williams, who were all members of the Perth branch of the Communists at the time, all claim that he was interested in communist politics more generally. They note that he attended party schools in Perth, organised by the CPA leadership, and he participated in debates and discussions about the nature of the USSR, the Marxist position on the state, the history of the socialist movement around the world and Australia, not just around the question of Aboriginal oppression. And when he was arrested, police also found general communist literature in his room, as well as copious notebooks, probably from those party schools, on a wide range of left-wing issues and socialist theory. So it seems like that was more, you know, a kind of post facto justification from McLeod. Leading Perth communists played a key role in building support for the strike. As I've already mentioned, McLeod sought advice and support for the strike from prominent communist union leaders across the country, such as Ernie Fortin from the Ironworkers Union. And the CPA itself played, you know, overwhelmingly a positive role during the strike. This doesn't mean that there were no problems with their politics, however. The Communist Party, after all, was at this time a thoroughly Stalinist party. And their commitment to Stalinist politics, in particular what was called the Popular Front, did shape the campaign on a number of levels. For instance, in 1945, despite Aboriginal workers seemingly ready and willing to go on strike, McLeod convinced them to delay it by a year because the Second World War was still going on. And McLeod's argument was not based, you know, on some narrow tactical consideration that would be hard to get support, which, you know, is legitimate at least to consider, but on a, in his mind, a principle basis that they couldn't go on strike because the pastoral industry was vital to the war effort and you couldn't undermine the progressive war against fascism. Then in the initial aftermath of the war, McLeod continued to voice opposition to an immediate strike. He argued as the Aboriginal workers had no economic resources, they would be defeated. And instead they must focus on winning control over some areas of land from the government. The Aboriginal workers could then build mines and farms in these areas and so have some economic independence that would then be mobilised to support a strike across the Pilbara. And McLeod was led to believe this was possible by the extremely optimistic perspective of post-war Australia promoted by the Communist Party and heavily shaped by their Popular Front politics. They saw huge opportunities for social and economic advance under a post-war federal Labor government and emphasised that this would be possible for an alliance of middle-class, working-class, and even progressive capitalist forces. And McLeod believed that in the Pilbara, the large station owners were so detested by the majority of the population that he could see the possibility of an alliance uniting together small business owners and small farmers, the rural workers and even urban capitalists around a program for economic development in the Pilbara that would benefit everyone except for the, you know, the station owners. And this program would include provisions for greater autonomy for the local Aboriginal population. Inspired by this vision, McLeod focused his efforts on winning over an organisation called the Northwest and Kimberley Advancement Association. And unsurprisingly, this organisation was not receptive to McLeod's ideas at all. At its first convention, Harry Green, who was the owner of one of the stations and a strong opponent of McLeod, was elected chairman, and the meeting endorsed the interests of the pastoralists. McLeod then tried to set up a more left-wing branch of the association in Marble Bar, which had, you know, more people than just station owners in it. However, at the first meeting of this branch, a motion was moved to censor McLeod, and the motion was passed overwhelmingly. Only one person voted against it, McLeod. In the aftermath of the meeting, the Department of Native Affairs Inspector, Lawrence O'Neill, wrote that McLeod had no standing in the community but along a small number of poor class whites. The Northwest and Kimberley Association would go on to vigorously oppose the 1946 strike and advocate for the segregation of Aboriginal children from schools. So, yeah, McLeod's kind of politics had inspired this program, but it crashed up against the reality that while small business owners and farmers might not particularly like the large station owners, they were utterly economically dependent on them. Furthermore, they had no particular economic or social interests in campaigning against the racist controls on Aboriginal people. And fortunately, once this was clear and it was rejected, McLeod refocused his efforts back on planning for the 1946 Pilbara strike. The problems of the Communist Party's politics, however, also impacted the Solidarity Campaign in Perth. I said before that they had taken the initiative in setting up the Committee for the Defence of Native Rights, which included broader forces such as liberal middle-class humanitarians, church leaders, academics, and so forth. However, problems quickly emerged. The campaign was attacked by the press and the Labor Party as being a communist front, you know, the classic kind of red-baiting, reds-under-the-bed scare campaign. And eventually the pressure of this led the middle-class non-communist members of the committee to ask the communists to resign and leave it, which they eventually did, although begrudgingly. Soon afterwards, the committee lapsed into activity within a couple of months, revealing that the communists had been the backbone of the organisation. Throughout the strike, the communists set up at least 12 different campaign groups, showing constant difficulties with working middle-class forces that they were so desperate to relate to. Eventually, they did find some who didn't seem to care very much that they were communists, but other problems emerged with these middle-class activists. And this came to a head around the question of fundraising for the strike. The middle-class people involved in raising funds had had a lot of success. After all, they know a lot of rich people who will give a lot of money, so it's nice. But they saw this as a form of charity rather than solidarity. So inevitably, the question arose, why are we fundraising for a strike? They could fundraise for something else instead. And as they told the communists, many of their middle-class friends felt sad about Aboriginal people, but didn't like the unions or strikes or anything like that. So why not fundraise to build, you know, some Aboriginal schools or hospitals instead of supporting the strike? And this revealed their essentially middle-class approach to Aboriginal issues. At the same time as this debate was going on, the strike in the Pilbara was actually increasing in size and hundreds more were joining it. And on top of that, the campaign started to make some more inroads into the Australian Labor Party, with local working-class branches voting to criticise their own state government. But these middle-class people wanted to orient away from the workers' movement and away from the strike, and so the communists parted ways with them and formed a new group, mostly now just with their members. You know, a lot of that is quite critical, but it's worth thinking about and considering, I think. But like I said to begin with, overwhelmingly, the CPA's contribution to the strike was a positive one. Not all sections of the labour movement supported the Pilbara strike. The Western Australian government was controlled by the Australian Labor Party for the first year or so of the strike, as I said before, and it strongly opposed it. The leadership of the Australian Workers' Union, the AWU, worked with the Department of Native Affairs to oppose the strike as well. When Pilbara strikers tried to find temporary employment on the docks during the long strike, the AWU refused to give them union tickets. And the AWU State Secretary, Charlie Golding, is reported as believing the Pilbara strike has been inspired by that damn communist Donald McLeod. And because he did not favour the tactics of this individual, he proposed to telegram the union representative, Port Hedland, stating that union tickets are not to be issued to anyone deemed to be a native, according to the Native Administration Act. And the AWU campaigned against the employment of strikers in other industries as well, such as in the railways, and joined an anti-communist crusade against the white station master who allowed them to be employed there. Now, these attitudes within the AWU didn't go totally unchallenged. There were rank-and-file meetings of AWU members where the decisions of leadership were overturned. And the attitudes of the AWU leadership also stand in stark contrast to railway workers and others who helped the strikers. But the leadership was very hostile to the strike. There are several reasons behind this hostility. The AWU were viciously anti-communist, so McLeod's role inclined them to be hostile. Also, the AWU was the backbone of the ALP-WA government. It had built up an important voting base for the Labor Party in rural Western Australia, including the Pilbara region, which was essential for the ALP to form government there. In order to do this, the AWU had worked closely with a layer of small and medium-sized station owners and become champions of the racist exploitation of Aboriginal workers. Coverley, who I mentioned before, was a prime example of this. He was on the state executive of the AWU, as well as an ALP MP for the region, and at various points, Native Affairs ministers. And he was one of the leading figures opposing the strike, even more right-wing than many of the Liberal and Country Party MPs. The strike continued throughout 1948 and into 1949. It was very difficult at the strike camps as the numbers of people increased. Aboriginal people struggled to get food and support for things like a school that they had set up, which was they tried to get kind of government support for, but it was not very forthcoming. But they kept fighting and refused to return to the stations. It became clear that the strike would not end and that most of them would never return. And pressure continued to build upon a newly elected conservative Western Australian government that came in halfway through the strike. But the whole situation seemed to have reached a stalemate. So in 1949, in another attempt to break the strike, the police arrested another round of strike leaders. And in response, the Seamen's Union, led by communist activists, initiated a ban on wool produced on the striking stations. 3 days later, the government caved and the workers won considerable concessions on wages and conditions. And probably a little hard to read, but that is the letter. It's like the telegram from the Seamen's Union of Australia to the government informing them that they're taking strike action. Most of the Aboriginal workers would never return to the stations, and there's a whole history about what happens after the Pilbara strike itself comes to an end, which is well beyond this talk, but something people can read about. The Pilbara strike, though, would leave an important legacy. Just to give a couple of examples. Inside Bootery National Park, there's a small building not far from Lake Mackenzie. Bootery is on the south coast of New South Wales, and it's home to the Wreck Bay Aboriginal community there. So, thousands of miles away from the Pilbara region. And at the park, there's a little kind of information building in which there's like kind of local wildlife and, flora and fauna and that kind of thing. But there's also a room which has a kind of potted history of the area. And it has like a cork board which has a whole bunch of photos on it celebrating the struggles of the Wreck Bay community for control over the national park, the land rights struggles of the 1970s. There's a famous shot of Gough Whitlam pouring the sand through Vincent Lingari's hands after the Gringy strike, and images of various anti-racist heroes, Nelson Mandela, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, etc. Outside of Whitlam, only one other white man is on the wall. And he's, a skinny man in a singlet with a tangled beard and sunbaked skin, the stereotypical Australian bushman, you would think. And it's this photo of Don McLeod. And I think that's really, it's just really fascinating because, thousands of miles away, Aboriginal people, can see this is a part of this common struggle against racism and exploitation. And here's another that really sums up the legacy as well. This is a kind of postcard that was created sometime after the strike. And in it, this Aboriginal young man, Dylan Cobert, was taught about the history of the strike. And he writes, "The strike made me proud." In terms of debates today about Aboriginal oppression and the working class and capitalism, the Pilbara strike is an important counter-argument to the widespread idea that the non-Aboriginal working class are this, super privileged layer of society who can never show solidarity of Aboriginal struggles. And in the 1940s, racism towards Aboriginal people was, much more overt and deeply held than it is today. The differences in the response of workers as compared to middle-class humanitarians also reveals the importance of a class analysis of strategies to combat Aboriginal oppression, while the differences between AWU and the more left-wing unions, as well as the role played by the Australian Communist Party, further shows the importance of political intervention by socialist militants and these kinds of struggles. And I'll end by just saying that if you want to find out more about this amazing history, you should check out this book. It's called, hopefully you can see that, On Red Earth Walking. It just came out last year. You can buy it in any bookstore, I'm sure. And it's a really detailed account of the strike, much more detailed than anything's come out before. And there's a website associated with it called Pilbara Strike as well, which has some great resources. And people can also check out the articles that Sarah mentioned at the beginning if they want to find out more about the questions of Aboriginal oppression, class, and capitalism. I'll hand it back to Sarah.